Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started. We have a very busy day today. We have a number of public hearings and possible work sessions. We also have a few ID work sessions. Let me give the room a little bit of a guide map as I know it as I speak right now. The following bills, all of the bills that are set up for public hearing and possible work session will have their public hearings. There are amendments or paperwork that is not in place for the following bills. So we more than likely will not be able to move those bills today, but they will be put into the carryover, so we'll make certain that they get picked up. So the following bills at this point that will just have a public hearing is House Bill 2183A, House Bill 2650A, House Bill 2693A, House Bill 3153A, and House Bill 3323. I have House Bill 2217 ready to go, meaning we have all the paperwork and amendments, and the same for House Bill 3230. Regarding the work sessions, it appears that we are ready to go on House Bill 2696. We are not ready to go on House Bill 2865A or on House Bill 3085A or 3376. Now, there are some amendments that may be ready for the work session bills. If they are, in fact, in our possession and if the committee is ready to go, we may adopt them so we can streamline when we get back together. More than likely, these will probably need to be put off till Tuesday. We'll still have two other time slots besides that that we can complete our work. So with that, we're going to start our first public hearing on House Bill 2183A. And Council, why don't you give us an update, and Representative Krieger, why don't you go ahead and come on up.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. House Bill 2183A pertains to the violation of making a false report of child abuse. It would, in fact, create this as a Class A violation. This level of punishment is commensurate with a failure to report on part of a mandatory reporter of child abuse.
All right, thank you, Wayne.
Okay, thank you, Chair Przanski, committee members. For the record, I'm Wayne Krieger, State Representative, District 1, South Coast. House Bill 2183 makes the knowingly making a false report of child abuse a violation. I think we need to understand that mandatory reporters are required to report, and they not need know that the abuse actually occurred, only have a suspicion, or something else has come to their attention. This bill started actually as a result of a constituent that contacted me, that's a constituent of Representative Nolan, clear out of that area, clear down to Gold Beach, and how she got my name, I don't know, but she called, we talked, and that's what this came from. But I think I want people to understand the key word, knowingly, the report, knowing or knowingly making a false report. That's key to the whole thing. This most often occurs in divorce cases to disqualify the husband or the wife from being able to have custody or visitation rights. And it's a vindictive act, and it's quite common, I come to find out, even since we had the hearing in the House, I had a lot of emails, letters, and phone calls regarding this. I think we need to understand that the person who is accused, in some cases, could be accused of a felony. And that becomes part of that record for there. Sometimes it's hard to disprove some of these things. And that's what the intent is. You put them in jeopardy, possibly, for the rest of their life. There's also the issue that I find when we did our dependency work group, when we did the work that we did on the sensitive review committees on several cases, it was evident that there was, I would call it at the very least, some exaggeration or at least some innuendos that are put out there for the purpose of making things appear a certain way. What happens then is DHS and sometimes the police have to do a pretty in-depth investigation only to find out it never happened and the person who reported it knew it never happened. And so those costs are also driving up the cost for the state of Oregon. There's been talk about that, well, it's already a violation to make a false report. Well, it does when you're reporting maybe to a fire department or to police department, but that part of it does not have to do with making a false report to DHS. And if you look at the disorderly conduct portion, it makes it a crime, but it requires that a public alarm has to take place, and this doesn't take place when you do this type of report to DHS. So I ask for your support of the bill. I think that there's a totally misunderstanding that it'll have a chilling effect on reporting, because we just need to educate people. Yes, you can make any report that you have any idea, you have any suspicion. The law requires you to do that. But when you know, and the word is knowingly, and you're doing it for that reason, then these people need to be held accountable. Now, Representative Garrett and I talked. He sits next to me up there where you are. And he felt that it needed to have the same type of penalty as failure to report, make it a violation, which we did. And, I mean, I hesitated because you're putting that person in jeopardy of a felony. But because he would support the bill, if we did that, we went ahead and dropped it down so it would be the same as making failure to report. Senator Cruz testified, I see he's not here today, because he was a victim of this. And if he does come in, I'd appreciate if you let him tell his story.
All right. Thank you. Before you leave, is there any questions for Representative Krieger? All right. Wayne, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And is there anyone, just scanning the room before we continue testimony on this, is there any other members here that have other obligations in the building that we need to take your testimony out of order? All right, I don't see anyone. We're going to go ahead and do the rest of the testimony on 2183. I have two panels that I'm going to call up based on for and against. So the first panel is going to be Gail Meyer, Roger Williams, and Gordon Hillsland. If you three would come up. The next three I have is Pamela Butler, Tonya Hunt, and then Gretchen Bennett. You will be on deck. And whoever wants to start.
Thank you. Chair Prasansky, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We talked a lot about this bill in our committee. Our membership does both sides of this issue. We have a lot of our members who do dependency work, which is very dependent upon prompt reporting of these kind of claims of abuse. We also have members who defend Measure 11 claims, and they know full well firsthand the devastation that can arise from a knowingly false claim of these kinds of abuse. We ultimately decided that we were in favor of the bill, and we want to commend the sponsors for presenting it. The beachhead of this really is seen in the domestic relations bar, but it's also seen in the criminal defense bar in many, many ways. We're brought in when the allegation is originally made, just through the investigation phase. Many times, the case does not get brought criminally because you can prove the claim was false. Sometimes the case does, however, proceed through the criminal system, and then it takes a full-blown-out trial. We understand the concerns about a chilling effect. In our ultimate conclusion, we don't think it really is going to prevail over the elements of this violation. When you knowingly make a false claim that is so different than from reporting something when you don't know one way or the other whether it's true or it's not. If you know it's a false claim, you should not make it. If you don't know, you should. And so we think on balance it's a good bill and we support it. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Who'd like to go next?
Go ahead.
Chair Prasansky, committee members, my name is Roger Williams. I am the legislative coordinator for the Oregon Home Education Association Network. We put on Apple Pie Day.
I ask you to move your microphone down just a little. There you go.
There, okay. False reports of child abuse where the can you hear me now? Where the report is knowingly false cause serious trauma for the families accused with effects often lasting years. These false reports are primarily made by individuals with malicious motives, such as ex-spouses in divorce cases or hostile neighbors or acquaintances. There are three arguments that I've heard made by opponents of this bill. First, they claim that false reporting is infrequent. Here in Oregon, false reports of child abuse as such are not tracked, so there are no reliable statistics. We do know that such reports are made. Senator Cruz testified before the House Judiciary Committee that he had been the victim of a false report of child abuse during divorce proceedings many years ago. Second, opponents claim that child abuse screeners and district attorneys do a good job of detecting false reports because in the instance of divorce proceedings, at least, it is usually obvious that there is a personal agenda behind reports which are false. The problem, of course, pardon me, is that these officials are not always accurate in their assessments, at least initially. Damage can be done to the victim's reputation even if the case is eventually dropped. Senator Cruz pointed out that as long as a father is under suspicion of child abuse, there is no chance he can have custody of his children. In addition, there are cases where children are taken out of their homes while investigations of child abuse are carried out, thus traumatizing those children. Third, opponents are worried that singling out false reports of child abuse from other false reporting will result in a chilling effect on the good faith reporting of possible child abuse by mandatory reporters and others. The concern is that possible reporters will weigh the possibility of being charged with false reporting and decide to not report if they are unsure about the abuse actually having happened. They may confuse knowingly false with turns out to be false. But that should not be cause to reject this bill. It is bad public policy to base laws on whether or not the uninformed will misunderstand the law. The correct course is to make the law clear and then educate citizens on what the law actually says. This bill has the same penalty for false reporting of child abuse as is given to mandatory reporters of child abuse who fail to report. It is a compromise between protecting victims of false reporting on the one hand and not impeding legitimate reports on the other. There needs to be a balance between those two, and this bill does exactly that. We support the bill.
All right, thank you. Gordon?
My name is Gordon Hillisland, and I'm from Portland. I would like you to pass this bill. I think if you read the law regarding child abuse and ask what teachers teach in elementary school to children and mothers, you will find a great difference. I was falsely accused of child abuse. My wife wanted a divorce. She told me to leave the house, and I refused. So a few days later, as I was walking into the kitchen, she hit me in the face and called the police and accused me of domestic violence and child abuse. Eight police officers responded and removed the family. Shortly thereafter, she got a restraining order, which, as you know, is a secret hearing where the accused can't defend themselves. The next week, a sheriff's deputy arrived at the door, and I was subsequently removed by two sheriff's deputies. I was falsely arrested for violating a restraining order, taken to jail. I went to court 6 weeks later. I was found not guilty of that. I was found guilty of resisting a false arrest. The judge determined it was a false arrest. During the hearing, the police lied about what they did to me. I called them liars. I spoke to the prosecutor the way he spoke to me. So I was sentenced, not because I was found guilty, but because I had demonstrated that I have no respect for people in the justice system, which is true. So I was sentenced to 5 days in jail, 2 years probation at $25 a month, and $750 in fees and fines. So my wife had removed all the money from the house, all the money from the bank, and all documents that would allow me access to money. So I had to move to Portland. I lost my job. Because I was a convicted criminal, it took me 4 months to get a seasonal job. I worked. Seasonally for 3 years, and finally got a full-time job. But it has cost me a lot. My wife's advisors were a female prosecuting attorney who would prosecute domestic violence cases, her administrative assistant, and several female sheriff's deputies and police officers. So I would like you to make sure there is a diseconomy for making a false statement and punishment for those who do. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for anyone on the panel?
Just more of a comment, but for Ms. Myers, you said you made the comment that until you can prove the claim is false, it's kind of a poignant statement, and you should have to prove the guilt, not prove the innocence. And so would you say that the assumption appears to be guilty until proven otherwise in these cases?
Chair Prasansky, Senator Whitsitt, members of the committee, certainly when you're in front of a jury, I don't know a defense lawyer who doesn't think that they do have to prove their innocence in front of a jury on these kind of claims. Just by merely announcing the nature of the charges to the jury, you can feel the pall in the courtroom. And I think most lawyers, defense lawyers, go into that knowing they're there to prove their client innocent. My comment was really at the front end of the claim before there's even an arrest. We're still in the investigation phase. That's when, quite frankly, again, you're trying to prove the absence. You're trying to prove a negative. Something didn't happen. But sometimes you can do it.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions? Thank you very much for coming forward, all three of you. Our next panel is going to be Pamela Butler, Tanya Hunt, and Gretchen Bennett. If you have written testimony, please hand it in. Please do not read your testimony into the record since you will be handing it in. And we have another panel that we're going to be bringing up after this based on people signing up late.
Good morning. My name is Tanya Hunt. I serve as Executive Director of Children's Center in Clackamas County, Oregon. I'm here also representing Gretchen Bennett and the Oregon Network of Child Abuse Intervention Centers. Gretchen had a death in her family late last week and could not be with us today. I've submitted written testimony for her.
Thank you.
Chair Prasansky, member of the committee, thank you for your consideration of this important bill. I do want to ask your opposition to this bill. At the Children's Center, we serve hundreds of children who are suspected victims of physical and sexual assault and severe neglect. Those children have been referred to us primarily from law enforcement and the Department of Human Services, who are investigating whether or not there has been a crime committed and whether or not children are safe in their current home environment. Those investigations are taken very seriously, and they're done quite comprehensively. We very rarely see cases of false reports at the Children's Center. The majority of our children are suspected victims of sexual assault and are under the age of 7. Any instances of suspected false reports pretty quickly come to light in our work at the Children's Center. I believe this bill is dangerous and that will have a chilling effect on reports from both mandatory reporters and other concerned individuals who care about the safety of kids. As I said, we see over 400 kids at the Children's Center. Those are not the kids that worry me. The kids that worry me are the kids we don't see because nobody has yet reported the suspected abuse. On average, children who are being sexually assaulted will report or disclose their abuse 7 to 9 times before they are heard and before that report is reported to the appropriate officials. So the fact that a child is trying to get the attention of officials, trying to get the attention of a caring adult, and the possibility that that caring adult could be dissuaded from making a necessary report is very scary and concerning, not only to me and the Children's Center, but also to the Oregon Network of Child Abuse Intervention Centers across the state. I will point out that I believe if we were here discussing whether or not a specialized bill for false report of rape or physical assault was being considered, I can't believe that we would be considering that. The fact that this is a child abuse false report bill seems to make it somehow different. And I would say false reports of child abuse are like false reports of any other criminal activity and are already addressed in the law. I appreciate your concern, your understanding, and would appreciate your opposition to this bill.
Good morning, Chair Prasansky, members of the committee. My name is Pamela Butler, and Policy and Outreach Associate with Children First for Oregon. We're here today to oppose House Bill 2183 because we do believe as Ms. Hunt does, that the bill is dangerous and would have a chilling effect across our state for those who are mandatory reporters and also those who are not. There's no data right now, as you heard earlier, with the Department of Human Services to prove that there are large numbers of false reports made. And in fact, the system that is in place is able to often, more often than not, able to distinguish real abuse from false abuse. We know that this process, and I know personally that this process, is very distressing to families, but if this means one less child who is dead at on our watch, then I feel like it's necessary. At this point, the only people who would even know the nuances of this bill if it were to pass would be those who are trained and those who are mandatory reporters. The general public, all they would know is that there is a chance that they could face criminal penalties for making that report. So in 2010, there were 71,886 calls made. Only 19.4% of those were from non-mandatory reporters. All the other reports were from teachers, Department of Human Service reps, medical professionals, police, people involved in the police. And still with that, last year, 22 children died from parent abuse. And those were cases that were not involved in DHS at all, and no calls had been made. So it's 22 children dead because people were too afraid to make the call. And we truly believe that this bill would only broaden that number and make more people afraid to make the report, because how would they know in the end that someone didn't accuse them of falsely reporting against them, and it would just begin the cycle. So the last thing we want to do is make a disincentive for someone to make a call that saves a child's life. And so I would urge you to oppose House Bill 2183. Thank you.
All right. Any questions? All right. The only comment, Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tanya, I want to make sure that I understand your testimony. You said that there aren't that many false reports that you see, and that it's easily detected if there's a false report.
In our environment at a Child Abuse Assessment Center, we have a lot of very well-trained professionals coming around this alleged case of abuse and looking at the facts and circumstances of that case. More often than not, we do see any claims of false reports, again, are quickly questioned. Any suspicion of a false report pretty quickly comes to light, and the case falls apart fairly quickly in our experience. Again, and those are very rare. The children we're seeing, again, are very young. It's very unlikely that they can be coached or can be persuaded to make false reports, and if they do, it usually does not hold up under questioning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions or comments? The only comment I would like to make, Pamela, when you're talking, you mentioned that this is be a crime. Based on the way it is written now, would not be a crime. It'd only be a violation. Thank you very much for your testimony. The next three individuals I'm calling up, Randy Ellison, Gabby Barton, Eva Rippentine. And again, with written testimony, I need you to summarize. We're going to run out of time. I've got two other bills with a number of people that need to testify on those as well. Who's going to start?
Oh, hi. My name is Eva Rippetoe, and I am here in representing AFSCME's Child Care Providers Together, Local 132. We represent licensed in-home, so registered and certified child care providers. Our providers have asked that we support this bill. They are mandatory reporters, but they have sometimes have disagreements with people, and it comes through in retaliation that people will call in reports against them. This shuts them down when it gets through the screening process. If it gets through the screening process, the provider gets shut down, parents have to come pick up the kids, and then the provider will be shut down for the duration of the investigation. Sometimes this is just an afternoon, sometimes it's longer. And not all complaints are criminal abuse charges, because I understand that that is a crime to falsely report a crime, but like in cases of neglect, as I understand it, that are not necessarily crimes, this would help our providers that get false reports against them have a way to find justice, too.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
And who's going to go next?
Hi, Chairman, committee members. My name is Gabby Barton. I'm 16 years old, and I'm from Eugene, Oregon. I'm here to ask you to vote no on House Bill 2183. In 2004, at the age of 9, I was sexually abused by my grandfather. In 2006, my mom, my sister, disclosed her information that she was sexually abused by him also. So when my mom asked me if he had done anything to me as well, I replied yes and told her what had happened. For most kids, sitting on their grandfather's lap was an innocent thing, but with me and my grandfather, it was not. After telling my mom, I had finally freed myself from the 2-year secret I had kept, though not as long as the 6-year secret that my sister had kept. Through many months of my parents trying to work with my grandfather to make things right, my grandpa partially admitted to the molestation in front of 4 family members. When he admitted, my family thought that we are on the road to recovery and to the family being restored. He made that partial admission on November 19th, 2006. On Thanksgiving Day, in front of 10 family members, he asked me to sit on his lap. We then knew that the road to recovery would not be as easy as we thought. By that time, my grandpa had been reported by a pastor and a counselor, and in January 2007, my parents reported the crime. He was indicted on March 2007. He refused the polygraph, which the district attorney recommended. He refused counseling, and he refused anything that would admit him guilty. On August 8th, 2007, when I was 12 years old, I testified against him in the court of law. 2 days later, the jury deliberated for 45 minutes, and he was anonymously convicted on all charges. While leaving the courtroom, after the verdict, my grandfather's sister looked at me and said, "Do you realize how many lives you've ruined today?" I have found that this blame the victim mentality is something that can hurt the victim more than the abuse itself. It is this mentality that fuels the cycle of shaming the victim, making them feel that it is their fault, keeping them from telling, and keeping family members from reporting. Because as you probably know, more than 70% of abusers are family members. To this day, almost 4 years after the conviction, there are 8 family members, adult family members, who refuse to have communication with me or my family because we held my grandpa accountable. It is to this day that they call me the liar. I know the pain of sexual abuse. I know how hard it is to disclose the information, and I know how hard it is for my parents to report my grandpa. I also know how hard it was to testify against him. But I know that I would not be a strong and confident person that I am today if it weren't for what my parents did and if I did not testify against him. I just got my driver's license this last week, so I know the physical roadblocks that we come across in life. Because I am a sexual abuse victim, I also know the psychological roadblocks that we come across. House Bill 2183 would create yet another one of those roadblocks for the victims of sexual abuse or for the person reporting, because it would create a fear to report. If the abuser denies, then I might be the one to get in trouble. Oregon needs to create an atmosphere that empowers victim survivors. I ask you to do that today by voting no on House Bill 2183. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Ellison.
Chairman Przanski and committee members, my name is Randy Ellison. I'm from Ashland, Oregon. I'm president of a group called OASIS, the Oregon Abuse Advocates and Survivors in Service. I received a phone call yesterday from a man that heard I was coming to Salem today to testify. He's a grandfather and first reported his daughter when his granddaughter was 1 year old. He and his wife reported her repeatedly, had a lot of family abuse back, a lot of feedback of why are you trying to ruin their lives and this sort of thing. A year later, a neighbor reported the abuse, and the granddaughter was taken out of the home, taken away from the mother. She was later put back with her. He went on to recount that the mother remarried, and beginning at age 12, the stepfather began sexually abusing the granddaughter. It continued for 4 years as they tried to do something about it. They tried to stop it. They tried to report it to no avail because they had no real proof and the family wouldn't stand behind it. Finally, when the little girl was age 16, they were able to take 11 family members to DHS and report it and get the stepfather convicted. The girl is now 18. She's living with a man and dealing with the right now alcohol and drug involvement, and she's got a long journey ahead of her, and I know that for a fact because I lived that for 40 years myself. Last week I had an email from a friend. She told me that she had recounted a story of a...
Mr. Ellison?
Yes.
I'm going to need you to summarize your testimony. It sounds like you're giving us anecdotal stories about the people. What we need, I understand that you've testified before, you've been before our committee.
Yes.
So I need you to summarize. I have about three more people who have now signed up for this bill alone, and I've got another set of bills I've got to get through today.
I'd be happy to. It seems like the bill needs to meet a couple of standards. One, that there's a known problem. There is, as much as I sympathize with anybody that suffered from a false report, I don't believe there are any studies that say there is a known problem. Also, that it's a good solution. And I don't see this as a good solution. I think it's something that has unintended side effects that will hurt victims, and I ask you to stop this bill today.
Great. Thank you very much. Questions for anyone on the panel? Gabby, I just want to say thank you very much for being willing to come forward and give us your testimony.
Thank you.
You bet. All right, our next panel is going to be Andrea Meyer and Mandy Marshall. All right, let's take. Amanda? Okay. Got a note, looked like it was an E on the end. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Amanda Marshall. I'm the attorney in charge of the Child Advocacy Section at the Oregon Department of Justice. We've got some mainly technical observations about the bill today, and one of which is a concern that placing this bill in Chapter 419B would be the wrong placement of this crime or this violation now, making a false report of child abuse something that's actionable. Your Honor, I'm sorry.
All right. I've been called worse.
Committee members, so you can see where I spend most of my time. Committee members, there is no violation or crime currently contained in Chapter 419B. As others have testified, there is a crime in Chapter 162 of initiating a false report, which is a C misdemeanor. Placement of this violation in 419B that specifically speaks to making a false report of child abuse to the Department of Human Services or law enforcement will be a more specific interpretation of that crime or of that act, which will make it difficult for district attorneys to actually prosecute people for a more serious matter, which would be a C misdemeanor, which is currently contained in Chapter 162. So in many ways, this will be reducing the available penalties that are available to deputy district attorneys if they are attempting to hold somebody accountable for knowingly making a false report of child abuse. So that's one observation, is that this bill could actually backfire in making it less likely that somebody would be held to a higher standard of accountability if they knowingly made a false report. The other thing it does by locating in Chapter 419B is it speaks directly to those folks who are currently mandatory reporters of child abuse. And at least in the earlier testimony that I heard before the Human Services Committee on this bill and some of the examples of the stories that led to folks thinking this was a really good idea don't have to do with mandatory reporters making false reports. Mandatory reporters, lawyers, doctors, social workers, therapists, teachers, police officers, those are the folks that are delineated in Chapter 419B. As I testified in the earlier committee, I personally provide training to lawyers across the state for the Bar Association and the Oregon Department of Justice on child abuse reporting and mandatory child abuse reporting. And one of the things that folks always ask is, what is my liability? Can I get sued? Can I get in trouble? What if I don't know for sure? And these are folks who are acting in good faith to make reports that are required under the statute. So the concerns that other folks have raised about the chilling effect of this bill, I think are really ring true in the sense that placement of this violation in 419B is the section of the statute that speaks to those mandatory reporters, and mandatory reporters aren't the folks who've been identified as the problem in making false reports of child abuse. So those are really the concerns that I wanted to express, is the specific placement of this in 419B. I don't think it belongs there. I think 162 already covers this, and at I think the best solution for people that think that 162 may not be specific enough on speaking to the crime of child abuse is to amend that statute that already exists to make it really clear that it also applies to reports of child abuse to DHS if they're knowingly false and made in bad faith.
All right, thank you. Before you leave, Amanda, what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you to hopefully be available to speak with our counsel, Aaron Knott, and let's let counsel and myself if necessary. We've heard what you said,
yeah.
But the tracking is to, from our perspective as prosecutors, why that would be difficult. We'll go through that
okay. In
greater detail to see if we think we need to ask LC to move it to another area. They usually select the areas based on their interpretation, so it may be an uphill battle, but we'll find out.
Okay, thank
Any
you.
Other questions or comments for Amanda? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
She was the last person I had scheduled. I'm going to ask once, since there's been a number of people that have trickled in wanting to testify on this bill, not seeing anyone raise a hand or jump up real quick, we're closing the public hearing on House Bill 2183A, and we're going into our next, which will be House Bill 2217.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2217 comes to you from Representative Buckley, exempts professional counselors and marriage and family therapists from punitive damage awards if they're engaged in conduct regulated by the appropriate governing body and they are acting without malice within the scope of the practice for which they are licensed.
All right, thank you. I believe we have Larry Connor in front of us. Mr. Connor, before you start, is there anyone else who wants to testify on 2217 today? Mr. Connor, when you're ready.
Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, my name is Larry Connor. I'm a licensed professional counselor from Portland, and I'm speaking to you as the president of COPAC, the Coalition of Oregon Professional Associations for Counseling and Therapy, which represents three professional associations: the Oregon Counseling Association, the Oregon Association the Oregon Mental Health Counselors Association, of which I am also the president, and the Oregon Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. I'm speaking today in favor of House Bill 2217, which, as far as I'm concerned, is a simple housekeeping bill to add licensed professional counselors and licensed marriage and family therapists to the list of professions who are statutorily exempt from punitive damages in lawsuits unless they are acting outside of their defined scope of practice or they're acting with malice. I will try to just sum up briefly. I think there's one main point here. The main reason to support House Bill 2217 is simple fairness and consistency in statute. As you can see on the statute, on the bill, that the following, I won't even read all of them, but all of these licensed health care providers are exempt under the statute. Psychologist, occupational therapist, social worker, physician, emergency medical technician, podiatrist, and on to pharmacist, medical imaging. We do not know why we are not on this list, so we're asking to be included on the list. And the main reason for that is consistency and fairness. If there were to be a lawsuit that included a licensed professional counselor or a licensed marriage and family therapist, I think it would be safe to assume that there would be punitive damages included just because they can be, and we would then be forced to hire private counsel and pay for that out of pocket because our malpractice insurance does not cover that. None of the other professions that are listed in the statute would have to be concerned about that unless they're acting outside of their scope of practice or they're acting with malice. So the rules would be the same for all of the licensed health professionals. Now, there are a few other things that I mentioned in my written testimony, but that is the big thing. So I ask you to support House Bill 2217 for the sake of consistency and fairness. Thank you for your time. I want it to be as brief as I could be because you're doing some very important things in here.
Thank you very much for doing so. Is there any questions for our witness? All right, thank you very much for coming forward. Again, is there anyone else who wants to testify on House Bill 2217? Not seeing anyone, we'll go ahead and close that public hearing. Bill, I understand we're ready to go on this one. I'll open up a work session on House Bill 2217.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2217 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2217 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And let's see. Senator Bonamici, would you be so kind?
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2217. We'll open up our next public hearing on House Bill 2650A.
Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee, House Bill 2650A governs when home health agencies are required to complete a criminal records check on any individual paid by that agency to provide home health services. I would advise members of the committee that there are several amendments that will be discussed today. I've asked the proponents to be prepared to explain the effect and import of those to you.
All right, I have a requested lineup on the panels. It looks like the boys get to go first. Jonathan and George will be followed by Fawn and Lauren. Gentlemen.
Is it okay if they go first and interview?
Well, I'm just reading the note here. It says two panels, John and George, and then Fawn and me.
Oh.
Me can go first. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Fawn McNeely, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Association for Home Care. OAC is a trade organization representing providers of skilled home health, hospice, and in-home care services throughout Oregon. We are here today in support of the A7 amendments, which were drafted to reflect the discussion in the House, where the bill passed 56-0. The A7s are also included as part of the A6 amendments that will be addressed later, and we are neutral on the other policy portions of the A6 amendments but would support their inclusion in House Bill 2650 if that's how the committee would like to proceed. House Bill 2650A and the proposed amendments would allow home health and in-home care agencies to continue the process we use today in relation to criminal background checks, following a process that will be outlined by the Oregon Health Authority through rulemaking. It removes the requirement these agencies have checks performed by the background check unit of DHS. Other agencies that are required to perform background checks through the background check unit are regulated by DHS, while home health and in-home care agencies are not. Our professionals in home health and in-home care agencies are committed to providing quality care with well-qualified clinical staff. As a measure of our commitment to patient safety, many of these agencies perform background checks before it was actually required by law. The goal of 2650 with the proposed amendments is to allow our agencies to utilize existing practices of performing background checks to minimize costs and maximize patient access to home care. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Lauren?
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lauren Rhodes with the Oregon Healthcare Association, and we represent private licensed in-home care agencies who would be subjected to changes included in the A7 amendments. We are supportive of those, and like Fawn and her home health agencies, we are happy to continue to perform background checks on prospective employees. What this amendment would do would be to allow us to save costs by not having to go through the background check unit at the Department of Human Services. Home health and in-home care agencies would be the only providers subject to paying costs. And right now, while rules have not yet been implemented from the 2009 legislation that created this new requirement, we do understand that draft rules that have been circulating show somewhere that agencies would be paying somewhere in the range of $85 to $135 per check on an individual. So what this would do is allow us to use lower-cost alternatives to continue to be subjected to those requirements, but to have alternative ways of making that a more reasonable burden on providers. We think this is a good proposal, and we'd like to urge your support. If you have questions, we're happy to take them and provide additional answers.
All right. Thank you. Questions for either of the panelists? Go ahead, Senator.
Mr. Chair, are the background checks equivalent in terms of the information that you get? You said there's a lower cost way of doing that. So the same information and the same quality.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, that's why we set it up so that it would be the decision would be made through rule how the health authority would require us to perform background checks so that we can take a better look at what private agencies are able to do in comparison to the state, and the health authority could then prescribe what it is that we will have to comply with in terms of setting up these background checks.
All right. Thank you. Ladies, thank you very much. Jonathan and George, why don't y'all come on up? While they're coming up, is there anyone else who will want to testify on 2650?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jonathan Eames. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Prevention Education Recovery Association, otherwise known as OPRA, statewide association representing alcohol and drug treatment providers as well as prevention advocates in the state. Thank you very much for listening to this bill, and also I want to emphasize we're in support of the Dash 6 amendments, which also incorporate the Dash 7 amendments, which Ms. McNeely and Ms. Rhodes just testified on. You've heard this issue before. It's been through your committee, not only this legislative session, but in past legislative sessions. And we had an issue come up last year in 2010 that we passed in through an amendment on a bill which gave a temporary fix to allowing alcohol and drug workers to work in their treatment facilities, in our treatment facilities. As you know, a number of these alcohol and treatment workers have had a history or a past that as sometimes due to addiction may preclude them from working in an alcohol and drug treatment facility through House Bill 2442 that passed in the previous legislative session. We had worked with the sponsor of that bill as well as other stakeholders to bring this bill forward, which would exempt fully and not just temporarily remove the sunset on allowing these workers to work in the facilities. These people give back. They obviously have had issues in their past, and they want to give back to community to help future folks who have addictions, and that's kind of the purpose for bringing this amendment forward. So,
all right, thank you. George?
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, for the record, my name is George O. Coolidge, here on behalf of mental health and addiction workers in support of the Dash 6 amendment. This amendment is necessary in order to prevent a substantial loss of qualified and effective mental health and addictions professionals. There's substantial research that indicates that services provided by individuals who are in recovery themselves result in better outcomes for their clients. Something about, you know, I've been there, I understand what you're going through, you're sick, and we can help you get healthy. Often addictions or mental health can lead to individuals being involved in the criminal justice system, which is sadly often when finally leads people to access the treatment that they desperately need. It's the central value of the recovery process to believe you can change your life for the better and have hope for the future. And so precluding people with these certain criminal records from working in the fields of mental health and addictions, regardless of what they have done to prove that they have turned their lives around, is kind of a contradiction to sort of the whole recovery process. It's necessary to include workers both in mental health facilities as well as addiction treatment centers because of the prevalence of sort of the co-occurring disorders and the need to treat both of these issues at the same time. And sort of an example I would just point out would be sort of an addiction counselor working at the Oregon State Hospital, or maybe a social worker doing mental health treatment that's working for a drug rehabilitation center. So these two fields are sort of very interconnected, and often patients need both types of treatments. We understand that patient safety is a priority, and so that's why this bill doesn't touch, you know, really high-level offenders, murders, tier one sex offenders. But, you know, for people who've proven themselves, who've gone through the system, who've gotten healthy, we see them as an effective, you know, tool in making sure patients are getting the treatment that they need. So we would encourage you to support the 2650, the Dash 6 amendments.
All right. Thank you. Questions for either? I have a comment. Jonathan, you said that I thought I heard you say the Dash 6 incorporated the Dash 7s.
That's my understanding, yes.
How would the six incorporate the seven?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're clairvoyant.
Yeah.
I think there was an understanding that if the committee was okay with it, we worked with the sponsor of the dash sevens to make sure that they were incorporated in the dash sixes as well. So you could just vote on one amendment.
All right.
I'm a little baffled because now I want to ask the proponents of the dash sevens if they support the dash sixes, and they're already sitting down back there. So,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, they could definitely come up, but I think
that's why they're supposed to come up second.
That's exactly right.
If I had only listened,
that was right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Fawn McNeely representing the Oregon Association for Home Care. We don't have a position on the policy components of the A6 amendments, but would support including them in the bill if that's the committee's desire.
So, but does the dash six have the dash seven actually in it?
Yes, Mr. Chair,
okay,
they
so
do.
What must have happened is the sixes were being worked on when the sevens were released, and we said, oh, by the way, why don't we put those in?
And Mr. Chair, there were actually dash five amendments that were drafted, and there was.
All right, any other questions? All right, thank you all very
thank you.
Much. All right. I think just to set the record straight, since we have now talked about the sixes, the sevens, and start at the fives, Aaron, why don't you just give us a quick summary of the differences?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. And again, this is an instance where we filed so many amendment requests at once, I think we actually transcended time. The A6 does contain everything that the A7 contains. What's common there is the portion about the instructions given to a home health agency about the nature of the criminal background check they have to make. That's located predominantly at Section 1, that first part. The real difference happens on, and I'm referring to the A6 amendments here, where they park company is on line 28 of page 2, which is where they switch over to talking about when, it comes up a little bit before, when public funds may be used to support the services of somebody who has a prior conviction. It creates a carve-out for individuals who work in a mental health or substance abuse treatment provider capacity. Right now, they are covered by the law and would be disqualified, and this sort of carves them out from that regulatory structure. So everything that comes above that is in both the 6 and 7 amendments.
All right, thank you for the clarification. With that, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2650A, and we're going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing on House Bill 2693A.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, 2693A comes to us from the sheriffs and impacts the method by which sheriffs or the agency required for issuing an administrative warrant would be responsible for reporting that warrant. Presently, if a department such as Department of Transportation, Revenue, or Employment wants to record a warrant and have it be active with the sheriff, that warrant is transferred to the sheriff, who then is responsible for recording it with the county clear lien record. This would modify and make the agency responsible for the recordation of that record and save the sheriff having to do it themselves.
All right, thank you. Ladies, who would like to go first?
I'll go first. Chair Przanski and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Christy Meister. I am the Chief Civil Deputy at the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office and member of the Oregon Sheriff's Command Council, Civil Command Council. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bills 2693A, and thank you for the opportunity. As mentioned there, current law now requires the departments to file or send their distraught warrants to the sheriff's office simply to get them recorded with the county clerk. So we basically take them, open them up, make a record of it, take it over to the clerk, and get it back and send it back over to the department. We're asking that the law be changed that allows them to streamline that and be allowed to send it directly to the county clerk for the recording. This does not affect the sheriff's ability to receive the distraught warrants to seize and sell personal property personal and real property for the collection of debt. That remains intact. Also, the Department of Revenue had House Bill 3261 out there, which affected some of the same statutes that 2693 affected. So we worked very closely with representatives of their department to come up with a mutually agreeable language and LC. And that's where 2693A became drafted. We also communicated with the other departments involved and had no objections at that time. We did recently receive information from the Employment Department that in the 2693A, inadvertently, there was penalties and interest that were left out, and they have asked for an amendment, which I think is before you today, to have that put back in so it's clear that they can collect that information, or they can collect that tax. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to appear before you, and I'll turn it over to my colleague, and we'll ask any or answer any questions that you may have.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, one thing that this bill will do...
First, give us your...
I'm sorry. Tammy Wood, I'm here from the Linn County Sheriff's Office and also from the Oregon State Sheriff's Association Civil Command Council. The departments, the various departments that send us the distraint warrants, we are allowed to collect $6.25 for each one of those. Once they send this and bypass us, we have figured that it's going to save the state somewhere in the $100,000 a year. That's not a huge amount, but when you look at the overall budget of the state, but it's still a large amount that the state can be spending otherwise. Also, in the last section of the bill that has really no relation to the distraint warrants, it provides the sheriff's return of service for a restraining order, a stalking order, be not hearsay as part of the Oregon Evidence Code. We have some district attorneys out there that require the deputy who served the restraining order to show up at the hearing to say that, yes, I served it, even if there is no opposition from the defense. This would still allow the defense to call the officer if there was a question about whether the service was valid or not, but this keeps the deputies from having to automatically go there just to say, yes, I served it and this is my signature. I would be glad to answer any questions you may have.
All right, thank you. Let me see if there are any questions. Any questions for our panel? Thank you all very much for coming forward. I'll tell you what, before you do step up, there is one, we do have a Dash 2 amendment. Are you familiar with the Dash 2 amendments?
Yes.
All right. And is this something that you are bringing forward, or is there someone else that was bringing the Dash 2s?
What happened with the Dash 2 amendment recommendation is that is where the Employment Department noted a technical error in the 2693A. And it now says that they can collect taxes, and it used to say taxes, penalties, and interest, and they're asking for penalties and interest to be added back in to the bill.
All right.
And we're okay with that.
I just want to get that on the record.
Yes.
All right. Thank you very much. Was there anyone else who wanted to testify on 2693A? Not anyone. We'll close the public hearing on 2693A, and we'll open up our next public hearing on 3153A.
Chair Przonski, members of the committee, House Bill 3153A would include reserve officers within the definition of peace officer and police officer for the purposes of the criminal section of the code. There are a variety of offenses which are predicated on something having been done to a peace officer, and peace officers have certain powers, so furnishing false information to resist, things like that. So this would add reserve officers for the purposes of all of those statutes.
All right, thank you. Judy Stiegler, Patrick Singh, and Bill Miller will be our first panel.
Thank you.
Judy, do you want to start off?
Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you.
Chair Przonski, Senator Cruz, and members of the committee, thank you for holding a hearing on this bill. This issue came to me about a year and a half ago. Oh, sorry. You would think that I would know the process. Hello. For the record, Judy Stigler. And I was the drafter of this, of 3153 originally, and Representative Barker and others took it over for me.
At any rate, this issue came to my attention about a year and a half ago by some reserve officers, particularly a fellow in Central Oregon who does training for the reserve officers in and around the Central Oregon communities, the law enforcement agencies there. Essentially, Mr. Knott has encapsulated the issue here is that for purposes of many of the criminal and traffic statutes, the term peace officer or police officer is used therein, but the definition has not necessarily included the a reserve officer, and oftentimes in certain situations and circumstances it is a reserve officer who is functioning in that capacity. So what we wanted to do was to clarify that when a duly authorized reserve officer is functioning in under the auspices of their commissioning agency, law enforcement agency, that their actions qualify, and specifically that where peace officer, police officer is referenced in the criminal and traffic statutes, that the actions of that reserve officer are inclusive of in the definition of police officer or peace officer. There were amendments made in the original version, and there is so we have 3153A engrossed that was passed out of the House, and basically that took out a section dealing with aggravated murder. And we also have a proposed amendment, the A2 amendments here today, it's my understanding. And what that would do is essentially take out the reference to previously the bill had referenced the definition that was held in 181.610, which is the DPSST definition, and rather than move it to a different part of the statute, it just the bill referenced the various places in the bill, other statutes reference that definition. What the A2 amendments do is to take out the reference to the 181.610, place the definition in 133.005 as a new subsection 4, and it deletes the reference to tribal officer. I'm very much aware that there's an issue going on, there's a conversation going on regarding reciprocation between tribal police and other law enforcement agencies. What we didn't want was this particular bill to get bogged down in that discussion. So what we did was put in the definition essentially that currently appears in 181.610, place that in 133.005 sans the reference to the tribal officer.
All right. Thank you. Patrick or Bill?
Go ahead. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Patrick Singh. I'm a reserve officer with the Portland Police Bureau. I'm also the legislative aide to State Representative Gene Cowan on the Central Oregon coast. Here on behalf of both entities to support House Bill 3153A. I'd like to thank you for hearing this bill on behalf of the 1,300 reserves that are across the state of Oregon, both part-time and volunteer. I'd like to thank Captain Ball for his leadership in this issue, as well as Representative Stigler as well. A little history behind why this bill is necessary. 15 years ago, reserves were defined in statute. That's the statute that Representative Stigler was mentioning, and an unintended consequence of that was that reserves were then left out of the various crimes that Council Knott had mentioned. Before you are the two pieces of written testimony that I submitted. One is a listing of all the organizations that are supporting the bill. In the past few sessions, there have been numerous attempts to try to solve this issue, but none as collaborative as the one we put forth this session by putting together a work group that was led by Representative Stigler and Captain Ball that gained the support of the major stakeholder groups, and also a letter of testimony and support from Portland Police Chief Mike Reese as well. For the past 2 years, I've been a reserve officer in Portland. to give you an idea of some of the training, I attended a six-month training, regional training academy through the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office, which consisted of about 400 hours, and I'm currently going through an 18-month field training program. During this time, I have been received extensive training in criminal law, patrol procedures, defensive tactics, and also firearms training. Our duties as reserves, including my duties as a Portland Police Reserve officer, include patrol support, assistance at large festivals and parades, and other large events, traffic control and enforcement, and also other special details. What I've quickly learned in my short time as a reserve is that members of the public generally do not distinguish between reserves and full-time officers. Our goal is to support the full-time police force, but as Captain Ball will probably mention, and as we'll see, we wear the same uniform, carry the same equipment, and drive the same police car as our full-time brothers and sisters. And that's why we need House Bill 3153, because it provides those protections while we are on duty. And again, thanks for the opportunity to testify, and I hope that you are able to move this to a work session as soon as possible.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I'm Bill Miller from Pendleton, Oregon. I'm a reserve deputy at the Umatilla County Sheriff's Office for the last 30 years. Before that, I was a reserve deputy here in Marion County for 12 years. I'm here to promote House Bill 3153A and explain how it pertains to reserve police officers. Today, I'm also representing Oregon Police Officers Association's 1,200 members, and I represent ORPO, Oregon Association of Reserve Police Officers, for which I am currently president. ORPO is a subchapter of OPOA. There are, as Patrick said, about 1,300 reserves in the state of Oregon. They work for both the small rural agencies and the largest agencies in the state. Reserves complement the regular paid officers for these agencies. In some smaller departments, reserves are often the only source of backup or relief for days off or vacation. Reserves usually wear the same badge and uniform as regular officers, so the public cannot tell the difference as a reserve performs the duties of a peace officer to ensure the safety of the committee, or the cities, and the counties. In Umatilla County, we have 8 regular patrol deputies to cover the county. We have 18 reserve deputies. 8 of these reserves are solo qualified. The reserves in total spent 4,900 hours last year working or training with the Sheriff's Office. Reserves have put in over 43,000 hours in the last 10 years in Umatilla County. The solo deputies each work about an average of 40 hours a month on patrol duties. Reserves are unpaid volunteers and do this job because they like giving back to the community. They are professional and have dedicated much of their lives to serving the citizens of the county. Last year, during the week of Pendleton Roundup, which was a 100-year anniversary, there were over 85,000, some people said 100,000 extra people in town. The Sheriff's Office used over 30 officers from outside agencies to complement the local law enforcement at the different venues. Many of these were reserves. Without reserves, we would not have had enough officers from the surrounding area to draw from to fill these duties. There's not any reason why reserves should not be regarded, should be regarded any differently than regular officer when it comes to definitions in the of a peace officer in the URS. House Bill 31A protects reserves to perform the duties as regular officers are currently, as reserve officers are currently doing. OPOA and ORPO support the House bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for coming forward. Let's see if there's any questions. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, just a very quick one. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Patrick, do we have the final version of Marine Reserves back from LC yet?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is a whole other issue that I do not want to get into.
Venus issue here.
Patrick, excellent response.
Yeah.
The chair agrees. All right, so thank you all very much for coming forward.
Senator, what's that? Thank you, Chair Pazinski. Patrick, the Dash 2 amendment, you support that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Whitsitt. The intent of our bill is to protect reserve police officers in Oregon while they're conducting their duty as is. Obviously, reserve tribal police get their authority from their individual Indian reservations, and what we don't want to do is blur any of those responsibilities. So yes, the Dash A2s would be a good to go into the bill.
All right, thank you. All right. Thank you all very much for coming forward. Our next panel, Corey Menderos, hopefully this is Vern Wells, and Rob Bovet. Corey, you want to start off?
Sure. Sorry, Chair, it's really long, enforcement friendly. Chair Prozanski, Vice Chair Cruz. For the record, my name is Corey Menderos. I'm a police officer, reserve police officer with the city of McMinnville. I've been with the city for about 18 years. I'm also the reserve coordinator, and I'm also the treasurer for the Oregon Associate Reserve Police Officers. I'm here to ask for your support for House Bill 3153A, and I want to kind of speak to you folks about how reserve agencies, especially from our agency, how we help with cross jurisdiction lines. It's the chair, I'm telling you. One of the examples our department does is we assist other agencies. Notably would be the Oktoberfest. I'm sure you guys probably took part of that. We send officers, full-time and reserve officers, over to Oktoberfest to assist with their agency. The Oktoberfest, the population for the city is about 3,500, but that increases to about 350,000 during Oktoberfest. With the department, about 10 officers, some of which are reserve officers, they need that help. So we send officers from our department to assist with Mount Angel for security, helping keep the event safe. But also there's a sense of ownership from the people from McMinnville. Representing our department, when people come and see me in uniform and they see the McMinnville, they feel a little, like I said, a little sense of ownership. They enjoy that. They get a kind of like a pride going on. I think that fulfills that community policing aspect that our department tries to strive. But it's not just to assist in events. Our department also helps out with incidents that happen. About a year and a half ago, there's a homicide that happened in the city of Newburgh, where Newburgh Dundee was actually working the homicide. They needed assistance because of a large crime scene. So they asked our reserve officers, who are trained from our academy, to go over and assist. We helped with not only crime scene security, but also processing of the crime scene, searching, and also investigations. It turns out that one of the suspects was a person I dealt with the city of in the city of McMinnville as a law enforcement officer. Long story short is that I ended up about 5-6 months ago testifying, and that person was found guilty. So you can see how our department and other agencies as well help, even outside of the city limits or the county limits, to help people outside of anywhere in the state, to help everybody as far as keeping, making sure that they can run whenever you have a large event or a critical incident. So I'm here to ask for your support in House Bill 3153. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Sure. Senator Prozanski and committee members, good morning. Thank you for allowing us to be here today. My name is Vernon Wells. I'm the police chief for the City of Independence, and I'm also representing the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. We are obviously testifying in favor of House Bill 3153A, and this bill, as you've heard, recognizes reserve police officers as a police officer in or for the purposes of enhanced criminal charges or for police officer line of duty deaths. I'm sure you know the situation already, so I'll try to make it really brief. I can give you a couple of different scenarios. Say a police officer and their reserve partner are working together, and a bad guy shoots at both of them, hurts them both. There will be enhanced penalties for shooting the police officer, but not his reserve partner. Same scenario, only both of these officers are killed. The full-time officer will get state benefits, death benefits. The reserve officer will not. We just don't understand why we should treat the reserves differently. Reserve officers work hard. They train hard. We expect reserves to treat the public just like full-time officers do. And so why shouldn't we treat them the same? Another interesting element of the law currently is that part-time employees are, by definition, reserve officers. So I have a part-time officer. She went through DPST, worked for several years as a full-time officer, but has elected to leave and go part-time so she can raise her new child. But by definition, she's now a reserve. So when she works for us part-time, it's a great opportunity for her to both stay at home and stay in the profession that she loves. It's great for us as well because it fills in. But she loses all of her benefits as a full-time officer, even though she has all the training, all the experience of a regular officer, and the people that she's filling in for. Reserve officers work hard to protect us, and I think we should work hard to protect them as well. So we certainly hope you support House Bill 3153A.
Thank you, Rob.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Bovette, District Attorney from Lincoln County, representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I had the privilege of working with the Oregon Association of Reserve Police Officers in past sessions to try to put together a bill. This time it's come before you, and we've got the consensus built. It's an excellent bill. I won't belabor all the reasons for it. You've already heard it. So I'd strongly, on behalf of ODA, urge you to move the A2 amendments into the bill today and to move it to the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much. The last group I have that are signed up at this point is Bob Ball from Gilmeyer. Why don't you come forward? And it looks like Andrea Meyer also wants to be on this panel.
That's the number I tried to put down.
Bob, I'm going to let you go first.
All right. Chair Przanski and Vice Chair Cruz, my name is Captain Robert Ball. I'm with the Portland Police Bureau Reserve Unit. I've served as a reserve officer in Portland for over 15 years, and it's been an honor and a privilege for me to serve the citizens of Portland in this way. Recently, I chaired a work group on reserve police officer issues that brought together law enforcement stakeholders from throughout the state. This type of work group had never been convened until now, despite various bills regarding reserve officers coming to the legislature almost every session in the last 10 to 15 years. I'm specifically going to address what some of the concerns have been about this bill. The first one is reserve training. Since certified reserve officer was added to the Oregon revised statutes in approximately 1995, DPSST has not funded to certify reserve academies, training, or officers. Many agencies have repeatedly attempted to submit their academy curriculums to DPSST, but DPSST hasn't been funded to undertake this function. In spite of this, cities and counties have professionalized their reserve officer programs because the public expects high-quality law enforcement services, and the liability and press scrutiny associated with police work is very high. There are at least 15 different reserve training academies in the state of Oregon. Virtually all the small agencies we polled attend one of these regional academies. They all consistently get hundreds of hours of academy and field training. And as you heard in testimony, even small agencies in Central and Eastern Oregon attend a regional academy with approximately 400 hours of basic training with a couple hundred of additional field training hours. The other concern previously raised about the bill was that the type of authority, that this may increase the authority of reserve officers. Currently, reserve officers have all of that authority within their jurisdictions. They are given that power by the chiefs and sheriffs, via state law. As you've heard in the testimony, there are sometimes the only officers working in many Oregon jurisdictions at a particular time, and part of their job is making arrests. Reserves are presently and will continue to be limited in what powers they are authorized to use based on their training and experience, but if the chiefs and sheriffs choose to, they already have those full authority within their jurisdictions. There was a concern about this may give reserve officers the ability to go into a home without a warrant. It's previous testimony, and we believe that was referring to community caretaking functions. We do that now. That's a very litigated and area of law that we're very aware of that we presently do. There's only certain circumstances you can enter into a home without a warrant. We practice the same procedures as any paid officer does, so that's something that we're aware of and we do. So those were the major concerns that were brought previously. Oh, there was one more, the fitness of reserve officers. and a state mechanism to remove reserve officers. The fact is that reserve officers, if we get one hint that there may be an issue with a reserve officer, it's very easy for agencies to remove them, and they are removed if there were any problems with those. So we'll leave my testimony at that for now, and I'll be open to questions if you like. You know, we're proud to come before you today, you know, with the unprecedented support of the Oregon Council of Police Associations, the Oregon Associations of Chiefs of Police, the Oregon Peace Officers Association, the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, the Oregon District County District Attorneys Association, the League of Oregon Cities, the Association of Oregon Counties, and the Association of Reserve Police Officers. And Patrick already submitted the letter from our chief supporting this, Chief Mike Reese, and I urge you to support House Bill 3153 as amended.
Thank you. And who wants to go next?
Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Firstly, I just want to acknowledge and commend all the reserve officers in the room and everywhere. I mean, it's the penultimate, I think, of the selfless civic servant that will put their life and limb in jeopardy on behalf of the public good, and I really do commend them. Our concerns arise from the fact that the bill would empower reserve officers with a full panoply of rights given to a peace officer by statute, and yet there would be no corresponding requirement for the level of training that is currently existing for peace officers through BPSST, nor the oversight nor the discipline. And I understand the comment that these reserves are already doing that anyway, and they already have training anyway. But my point is that right now, those decisions are being made by local public entities, whether they be municipalities or county sheriffs. And there's a patch quilt. But what this bill would do is basically codify a statewide provision that would empower all reserves everywhere with the full panoply of these rights in 133, and yet not correspondingly insist upon a certain level of training and a certain level of discipline and oversight. And I question whether that's really good policy on a statewide level to do that. What I worry about is what we don't know is what we don't know. I'm sure all the officers here in the building today and who have been active in this bill are adequately trained. The question I have is, what about those smaller entities who are not here? We don't really know their level of training and how they employ their reserves because they're not here. And what I also don't know is what it will look like later, maybe 5, 10, 15 years from now, fiscal constraints being what they are. Might a public entity become more and more reliant on reserves to do not just traffic control, but respond to 911 calls, and yet, because of fiscal constraints, train them less and less? And there'll be no oversight. We won't really know that when and if that event comes. So we fully agree that reserve officers, when working in the line of duty, there should be enhanced penalties if they're subjected to harm or if a defendant attempts to assault them or anything of that nature. We don't have quarrels with that. We just simply raise the level of caution that by purview of the statute, the legislature would be empowering reserves, and yet there would be absolutely no oversight on a statewide basis. Thank you.
Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. We too share concerns, and I want to point out what we're sort of jumping over in the statute. The current statute, ORS 181610, we actually already have both a definition for reserve officer, but we also have a certified reserve officer definition, and you've heard reference to that. And that is ORS 181610-3, which means a reserve officer who has been designated by a local law enforcement unit has received training necessary for certification and has met the minimum standards and training requirements established under ORS 181640. So we share the concern that we're moving up reserve officers with not the sufficient DPSST training that we require
Not even a level lesser than that. I believe the police officers, it's 16 weeks. I don't know what the certified reserve officers, it's not clear under subsection 181.640 what their level of training would be, but it would certainly be more than what is currently the training for reserve officers. I think we need to fund the certified reserve officer with DPSST, ensure that those officers have a level of training, and then look at elevating them in this statute instead of the statute with the provision related to reserve officers. We just believe very strongly, as Gail Meyer talked about, the necessary training going along with the necessary power and authority given to them, and we're skipping over that here.
Question. Senator Dingfelder first.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Mr. Ball regarding discipline. So can you explain to me, because I'm not clear on how discipline would work for a member of the reserves and a member of, say, the Portland Police?
The same as. We're considered a member of the Portland Police Bureau, so we have the same disciplinary procedures, and we're held accountable for all of those same procedures, except that we're not a represented entity by a union. So if the police bureau, the chief at any time can decide if they believe a reserve officer isn't acting in the best interest of the city or is not performing their job effectively, they can terminate them immediately without cause.
Okay. And as a follow-up, I think it would be helpful to have any statistics. Obviously, I represent the city of Portland, so I'm most interested in that jurisdiction. But for any disciplinary actions, and I'll follow up with the city of Portland on this, that have already, you know, been held against reserve versus full-time officers that are trained through DPSST. I'll follow up with the city directly on that.
All right.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments, Senator? Excuse me.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. I had a question, just whether you can help me out sort of statutorily with this, because I was trying to figure this out. So in terms of the actual powers that would be gained as a practical matter from going from a reserve to a full officer, we heard testimony on the House side that that these reserves are already, they're making arrests, they're running missions in a lot of counties, they're over 50% of the police force, especially in rural areas. And so I've been trying to figure out, I'm aware of the certification requirement, and that does go to training, but in terms of responsibilities, because Gail, your testimony was about this, that they'd have more power as the result of this. Statutorily, what would those additional powers be, except for things like if somebody drives off and they say stop, all of a sudden that's a felony elude, except instead of a guy just saying stop who can't actually stop them?
Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee and committee council. It's not so much that the statute would be broadening the powers, I think. It's the question of who bequeaths the powers. Right now, it's the local public entity that commissions the reserve officer that empowers them. And they can constrain it. They can say, you're only doing traffic control during parades. Or they can say, you're doing everything, and if we get a 911 call, you're the only one on duty, you respond. But it's the local entity that is making that choice. It is the local entity that is liable for that choice and that is accountable to its members for that choice. What this, and perhaps this is esoteric, but I think it's more meaningful than just that. This bill, by statute, empowers all reserves officers everywhere in every jurisdiction and entity with the full panoply of rights given to peace officers, regardless of the amount of training and oversight. And there may be pockets of entities in this state, and if I'm sure some exist now, but there may be more later, who don't really have the rigorous training required that you would otherwise have through DPSST. So it's not necessarily that on the ground the reserve officer would be doing anything different. The question is, does the legislature really want to be in a position where it's empowering peace officers who have weapons, who can use them, use deadly physical force now because of this bill, without simultaneously also insisting upon a level of training and a level of oversight. That's the issue.
Thank you. Other questions or comments? We've got two comments. Galvin, your testimony, I can assure you that I know reserve officers already do respond to 911 calls. And as you also stated, it is going to be the local government entity that's going to be liable for who they hire and what they actually allow to do. And no matter what we do with this bill, they're going to be the same ones that's going to tell their officers, as they would their full sworn officers, as to what they're going to be able to do or not to do. That's going to be a prerogative of the chief. He or she will be making under the guidelines of their city or their counties. So that's my observations from my work with reserves. Any other questions or comments? Thank you all very much for coming forward. And I think that's all we have for House Bill 3153A. One more time, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 3153A. And now we're going to go ahead and open up our public hearing on House Bill 3230.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 3230 comes to you from Representative Hoyle. What it basically does, it makes the violation of practicing dentistry without a license changes it from a Class A misdemeanor to a C felony.
All right, I've got Daniel Saucy, and then Courtney, I see you're here. Is Representative Hoyle coming up, or are you going to patch? No, that's fine. Gentlemen, and I've got only one listed, so you're going to have to tell me who else is coming up.
Patrick Bryce with the Board of Dentistry.
Which of the two would like to get started? Just give us your name and then go ahead and your testimony.
Good afternoon, or good morning, Chairman Brzezinski and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Daniel Saucy. I'm a general dentist here in Salem, and I am the chair of the Government Relations Council for the Oregon Dental Association, and we're here today to support House Bill 3230, which increases the penalty for practicing dentistry without a license from misdemeanor to a felony.
Mr. Saucy, we have your written testimony. I ask you not to read it, but summarize it, please.
That's different than this. But okay. As the leader of the dental team, we're committed to safety, and unfortunately, we see a growing practice that threatens both these goals of safety and quality of care. And in most cases, these stories are unsettlingly still.
Reading your testimony, I've got it right in front of you.
Okay.
So maybe you meant to hand something else in. Why don't you just tell us why it's important for us to do this?
Unlicensed practice of medicine is a felony. The unlicensed practice of dentistry is a misdemeanor. And there's a, why get a license? Misdemeanor is a slap on the wrist. And we've got the dental board is not able to aggressively or effectively stop dentistry. That's people are practicing dentistry without a license.
All right.
People are being hurt. It's all kinds of things are going on that are just mischief, and we don't have a way to control those.
Great, thank you. Patrick.
Yes, thank you, Chair. My name is Patrick Brotz. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Board of Dentistry, and I'm just here to lend the support from the board for this legislation. We've had a number of cases over the past 8 to 9 years that I've been the Executive Director where we have taken action against individuals who are unlicensed. We've investigated the cases and proceeded with them to local law enforcement and the District Attorney's Office. But unfortunately, because they are misdemeanors, they go nowhere. Medicine, as you well know, is a felony. Dentistry years ago could have been a specialty of medicine. Instead, it's a separate form of health care. Obviously, Dennis, Dan, who's a good friend here, but he has pointy little instruments and can hurt people very seriously. Two particular cases we had that came to the board were serious infections where the individuals, had they not got regular treatment, would have died. We were able to take action in one of them with local law enforcement, but it's because the dentist injected the person with an antibiotic across the line of medicine. So then they did a grand jury. By the time the grand jury indicted her, she had fled the country. The other one is a case currently pending in Multnomah County Court, we were after a dentist who we've been after for almost 10 years, I should say, an unlicensed dentist, who eventually we didn't have to worry about because he murdered someone. When someone came for dental services, he shot him and killed him. So now he's in jail, so we don't have to worry about prosecuting that portion of the case. But in working with the police department in Gresham and the district attorney's office, they weren't going anywhere with the case because it was a misdemeanor. It just didn't rise to the level. This will make it rise to that level.
Thank you. Representative, thank you for joining us. I understand you're in committee, so if you'd like to give us your testimony and leave, feel free to do so.
Okay. Val Hoyle, I represent West Eugene, Junction City, and thank you very much for taking the time to listen to my testimony today. This is a very simple bill. I think much has been said about why we need this. It isn't very often that we find someone that's practicing dentistry without a license, that are putting people in danger, but at the end of the day, just like with practicing medicine, when you practice dentistry without a license, you can really put people in danger. And one of the things we talked about, concerns that some of my colleagues in the House had, were that people that utilize dentists that don't have a license may be poor or may be immigrants or may not have the same access to other dental care. And what I would say is just because you're poor, just because you're an immigrant, doesn't mean that you shouldn't have access to the same kind of safety. I mean, the problems that you have when you don't use clean instruments, I mean, there's blood-borne diseases, there's infections, there's major damage that can happen to a person's mouth. What we want to make sure is that we have consistency in our sentencing guidelines for practicing medicine without a license as to practicing dentistry without a license. In the past 10 years, there's only been four cases where the dental board would have used this, but in those times, they really didn't feel like they had the tools to protect consumers.
All right, so we'll have questions, and the reason I made the comment I made, I see the staff that are like, they need to usher her out. So
I think we have a vote coming up in business and labor.
My question isn't necessarily to Representative Hoyle if she needs to go back to her committee. I'm just curious, are these cases typically people who were licensed and have lost their license, or are they just somebody who decides, I want to be a dentist today? And
Are licensed in other countries or in other states? And some of them lost their licenses and so move here, and then some of them had licenses in other countries and then they come here.
I have a question for good representative.
Thank you so much.
Senator Hoyle, I think you need to sit down.
Did he say Senator Hoyle?
Yes. I think you're confusing the chair, representative, but I do have a question. I'm just curious, when I looked at the SMS, I did see that there was a lot of no votes over in the House, if I'm looking at this correctly. So
yeah.
I'm just curious if it was, I mean, you know, there has been concern about that judiciary committees do add a lot of additional crimes to the books. So I'm curious about why there are so many no votes.
If you looked at the no votes, that is a set of no votes that are across the board. There's no single
political.
It is bipartisan. It is. I think the comment was, I don't think I've ever seen that many people vote no the same way on one bill. And people voted no for a number of different reasons. One, it was a week before the deadline where bills were starting to die and people were a little cranky. Two, there were some of my colleagues that felt like this targeted people who were immigrants. There were some colleagues that felt like this was a bill that was possibly giving aid to illegal immigrants. There was colleagues that felt like this should have gone through the Judiciary Committee in the House, and that not having it go through the Judiciary Committee meant it didn't get looked at as hard. So that was why we put this through the Judiciary Committee here. One of my colleagues had a bill about strangulation, increasing the fines for strangulation, and he didn't get to hear his bill and said, I'm voting against this because my bill didn't get heard. It was a really, really interesting discussion, and at the end of the day,
it sounds like it didn't necessarily have to do with the substance of this bill.
Not at all.
So, let me just put on the record, I'll make certain that the President of the Senate understands that the reason the bill was sent to the Judiciary is because the Representative had it come to the Senate Judiciary Committee.
It was important. If that was a concern on the other side, we wanted to make sure that we addressed that concern when it came over here. Because it's a good bill. We think it's a good bill.
Thank you.
But thanks for asking the question.
Yeah, thank you. A comment and a question. Kind of the same situation in veterinary medicine where the very difficult to get prosecution. It's not not very high on the queue of importance from the district attorneys. Question, you indicated that one individual was eventually charged because they practiced medicine by injecting an antibiotic. It would seem that administration of an anesthetic would also be the practice of medicine. And there are very few dentists practice anesthetic. Very few dentists practice a second time if they don't use an anesthetic. Let's put it that way.
You're correct, Chair Przanski, Senator Wilson. It is, but again, because of the fact that we're at a misdemeanor level, it doesn't rise to that level when we're trying to prosecute.
Thank you.
You betcha. Senator Cruz.
What's the penalty for practicing medicine without a license?
I'm sorry?
What the penalty for practicing medicine without a license? What is
it's,
that?
It's the same as this.
It's the
yes.
The Class C?
Yes.
Okay.
Anything else? Another thing I just want to put on the record, because I think Representative Hoyle brought this up and it's worth noting, for individuals who may be, let's say, poor or not able to on a fixed income, or that maybe immigrant may have those same issues. There are different mechanisms, I believe, other venues that they could go through to getting a licensed dentist or maybe someone that's in a school of dentistry to be able to look at them.
That is correct, Chair.
All right. I want to thank you very much, and Dr. Saucy, thank you for being here. I apologize if I seem a little gruff in getting you through this.
I'm here to support the bill, whatever you need.
All right, we're here.
Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on House Bill 3230? We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3230, and 3230 is ready to go from what I understand. We've got all the paperwork, so I'll open up the court session on 3230.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3230 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3230 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objections? So ordered. And Senator Wissett, would you carry this one?
Sure.
And Senator Wissett will be our carrier on 3230. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 3230. And we'll open up our last public hearing on House Bill 3323.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3323, the amendments replace the bill. You may remember a similar bill.
Which amendments?
The Dash 2 amendments. That passed out of Senate Judiciary and then just the other day passed House Judiciary relating to pornographic material on computers. What this bill does is the Ninth Circuit, in the case of Project v. Kroger, found the bill that we worked on in 2007 as it relates to giving pornographic material to children or luring minors for sexual conduct and activity, found most of it unconstitutional. What this bill would do is remove those unconstitutional provisions from the Oregon laws. It would repeal ORS 167-504 and would substantially amend 167-057. Actually, I've got that. It should be. Hold on a second. I got the number wrong in my staff or something. 167-054. Okay. Chairman of the committee. What arguably is having the statute on the books is a trap for the unwary, because it's unenforceable and someone may attempt to enforce it and then get into legal difficulty.
All right, thank you. Andrea?
Good morning. Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. It's not been that long a morning. we asked for the preparation of the Dash 2 amendments in, because although I notice it says Project v. Kroger, but it's not. It's Powell Books v. Kroger. In 2007, the Oregon legislature, as council indicated, passed some statutes. The ACLU urged that they not proceed because we thought they were unconstitutional. Despite our best efforts, we weren't successful, but we were in the courts. And on behalf of Powell's Books, and a number of other plaintiffs, including Darcy Dark Horse Comics, the American Booksellers Foundation, Planned Parenthood, Cascade AIDS Projects, and others. We sued and challenged portions of that law and were successful in the Ninth Circuit on September 20th, 2010. The law went too far in its scope to try to deal with providing sexually explicit material to minors. What is remaining in the law and we think is good law, and I will walk the committee through the Dash 2 amendments because they're long and I will explain briefly what those sections provide. But what's still good law, and we approve of that, is the ability to provide sexually explicit material to minors for the purposes of luring or grooming them to sexually assault them. But where the statute went too far, and I'll just give one quick example, is that it would have potentially criminalized Where Did I Come From, because of this drawing of the depiction of intercourse. So certainly I don't think that was the intention of the law, but it went too far, and so the Ninth Circuit under the First Amendment, not our Oregon Constitution, held a good portion of unconstitutional. So we are seeking to clean it up, both because, as counsel said, we don't want prosecutors or law enforcement to be using the wrong portions. We want them to be using the correct portions and to be using it and not to realize and not to know that part of it is still good law. So if I can quickly walk through, because there's a lot here, but I can summarize. Section 1 cleans up the definition sections that were used in 167054 and 167057. And so that's a cleanup of the language that isn't necessary because 167054 was unconstitutional entirely. Section 2 is then the cleanup of ORS 167057 to retain the part that is the luring minors to provide them sexually explicit material with the intention of harming them. Then if you skip, Section 3 is references ORS 131125. That's the statute of limitations. So it's simply removing this crime from the statute of limitations listing. So if you skip through to page 6, that takes us to Section 4. That is ORS 131602, and that's the criminal forfeiture statute. So again, removing those provisions from that section. If we proceed then over to page 12, Section 5 is the definition section of crimes and punishment, and it simply removes, again, the reference to those two that statute in that section. Page 13 is Section 6, the racketeering statute. Again, cleanup to remove it from that. And Section 7, appearing on page 17, is related to TSPC licensing, where you're prohibited from getting a license as a teacher if you've been convicted of certain crimes. Again, it removes that. Section 8, on page 19, is the criminal records check related to that issue. And I forgot to check what Section 9 was. My apologies. Oh, it's a continuation regarding, again, the criminal history background checks. And finally, tucked into page 22 at the bottom, is the repeal of the other provision, ORS 167054, the one that was struck down in its entirety. Again, we challenged 054 and 057. 057 survived portions. 054 did not. So we are asking this committee to adopt the Dash 2 so that we can clean up our statutes and have no one following unconstitutional provisions. There will be no further appeal to this case. It is closed. The Department of Justice is aware of this request, as is Representative Barker, whose name is on the original bill. And so we ask you to proceed, and I'm happy to answer any questions as to the merits or the substance of this request.
Question, Senator Bomici.
Just a quick one. Since you mentioned it, Andrew, you said Representative Barker and the Department of Justice are aware of the bill. Do they have a position or are they?
Chair Pozanski, Senator Bonamici, the reason I noted that they're aware of the bill is their names are on the original bill as a courtesy. Department of Senator Representative Barker indicated no problem to me about moving forward with this. He hadn't had a chance to look at it in detail. I just explained. And Department of Justice had it and were reviewing it. I think if they had any concern, they would come forward and let me know. But they were aware of what we were trying to do. And I thought it appropriate in light of the fact that we challenged the law and they're quite aware of the penalty of what happened when we prevailed in terms of attorney's fees and other things. So I think it's all good governance around.
All right. Other questions, comments? All right, counsel, regarding the Dash 2s, I know we need to adopt those. It doesn't look like we have the paperwork on the Dash 2s.
Well, we do not have the fiscal impact statement.
All right, would it be better to go ahead and adopt the Dash 2s for that paperwork to be done?
Sure, it would move the process along, sure.
Right. So anyone else who wants to testify today on 3323 and specifically the dash twos that we've heard today? Not seeing anyone come forward, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 3323, and we're going to go A, and we're going to go ahead and open up a work session for the purpose of adopting the amendments to 3323A. It says A in one place, but it looks like it's actually just plain. The measure summary is wrong.
Dash twos.
Okay, because if it's A, then it isn't A.
Right.
So.
Chair, members of the committee, I was addressing the amendments, so I assumed it was going to go to A and okay. Move the bill. So.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendment to House Bill 3323.
All right, Senator Cruz moves the dash two amendments into House Bill 3323. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. We'll close the work session on 3323. And now we're going to just move for a second on the work sessions. It looks like we're ready to go on the first one, so I'll open up the work session on House Bill 2696.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, we first heard 2696 back on the 3rd of May. This bill pertains to the regulation of the sale of scrap metal. Recall that currently there are provisions in the law essentially authorizing different methods of sale, check delivery, and such for commercial sellers and individuals. In neither category do you find nonprofit corporations. House Bill 2696 would have the effect of creating a new subcategory of commercial seller regulating nonprofit corporations who would receive checks mailed to their place of business. House Bill 2696 would also allow the direct release of a check. Normally there's a statutorily mandated waiting period to an individual or nonprofit corporation if they're able to obtain written authorization from a relevant law enforcement agency. Basically, if they're a known actor, familiar to everyone, they're coming in multiple times, this would allow them to bypass the process of receiving a check by mail every single time. At committee's request, there was an amendment drafted. This is the dash one amendment. The dash one amendment addressed the fact that that latter requirement of written authorization didn't have any sort of a custodian. There wasn't anybody who was actually going to be keeping track of them. So the new dash one states, the scrap metal business shall retain the written approval for 1 year following the date the approval is received. As amended by the dash one amendment, House Bill 2696 is expected to have no revenue and no fiscal impact.
And we do need to adopt the dash one.
That is correct, Chair.
Chair, I move the dash one amendment to House Bill 2696.
Senator Cruz moves the dash one amendments into House Bill 2696. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2696 as amended by the dash one amendment of the floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2696 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair will carry 2696 to the floor. We'll close the work session on 2696. All right, now we're going to do the homework that we need to take care of. All of the bills that we've heard of this today under the public hearing and possible work sessions that were not moved today will be carried over until Tuesday, May 31st. And I'm going to go through the list, but the intent of the chair is just in case I, for whatever reason, missed one right here, we're going to see, make sure we don't. But anyone that was heard today as a public hearing that was not passed out of the committee will be going over to May 31st, which is Tuesday, for work session. Those include House Bill 2183A, House Bill 2650A, House Bill 2693A, House Bill 3153A, and House Bill 3323. So, Katie, did I catch everyone? All of those? All right, so that's going to take care of those. Now, regarding the ones that were set for work session that we said were needing to be held over, we are also carrying them over to Tuesday, May 31st. Those include House Bill 2865A, House Bill 3085A, and House Bill 3376. And did I cover the, no, I've got those covered from what Katie says, so I think we're done for what we needed to give notice. All of those bills that are being carried over, again, will be carried over for the purpose of work session. And then for tomorrow, we are starting at 8 o'clock again. So if everyone can be here, we have another packed day. And as can you see, it took the whole time. With anything else before we close? We're there. All right. Thank you. We're adjourned for the day, and we'll see everyone tomorrow morning. Thank you.